So now we'll ask our brother Greg to come forward and speak to us on his subject this evening in Bible class, More Lessons from Job. Brother Greg.
Thanks, Brother Mike. So, as I kind of hinted, a little while ago, this Bible class contains two themes that we've considered over the past year or so. So the topic that we sort of dealt with in depth, questions in the Bible, and then in an exhortation not that long ago, trying to get a better understanding of the book of Job. I personally wanted to do this, is a bit selfish, because there were still more questions that were unanswered for me, and it really bothers me when there's unanswered questions. So I had to go in and find out more about it and find out more about the things that were really bothering me, the context of Elihu's speech, and then the subsequent discussion between God and Job. And obviously, I haven't plumbed the depths of all of this. I'm still working on it. But I think I have a better understanding, and that's what I'm hoping to do tonight, to impart some of the things I've learned, and hope that you'll find it interesting as well. And when we considered the topic of questions in the Bible, the key points are we're focused mainly on why God and particularly the Lord Jesus Christ ask questions, particularly when they already know all the answers to them. And the importance of focusing on whatever questions they ask, because they're obviously really important questions, and we found that with every single instance that we looked at. Additionally, in the exhortation I gave a few weeks ago, I want to bring a better appreciation for the lessons that are contained in the book of Job, because to me it was often kind of overlooked and I tended to skim over it because I don't think I had a full understanding of the context of the arguments between Job and his three friends and what Elihu was doing in the middle of that, and then particularly what God says in those last few chapters leading up to chapter 42, which seems pretty straightforward when you look at it. So that's kind of where we're going to go tonight. If you remember, the book of Job is divided into three sections, the prologue, chapters 1 and 2, the dialogue, chapters 3 to 37, and then this monologue in chapters 38 to 42. And you remember kind of the context is Job's trying to argue his case for he didn't really deserve to be afflicted like this. And so just stepping back a little bit into Job 29, you'll probably need to open your Bibles. I'm going to make you work a little bit. Going back to Job 29 and looking at verses 7 to 13, he first of all, in this latter part of Job, in this argument, starts to make a case for his upright character in his public life, the things he was doing in the community. So if you look at chapter 29, verse 7, beginning at verse 7, he says, "When I went out to the gate through the city, when I prepared my seat in the street, the young men saw me and hid themselves, and the aged arose and stood up. The princes refrained talking and laid their hand on their mouth. The nobles held their peace and their tongue cleaved to the roof of their mouth. When the ear heard me, then it blessed me, and when the eye saw me, it gave witness to me. Because I delivered the poor that cried, and the fatherless, and him that had none to help, the blessing of him that was ready to perish came upon me, and I caused a widow's heart to sing for joy." So he makes a pretty strong case for the things he was doing outwardly in his public life. And then he continues on that, to chapter 31, he expresses his upright character in his private life. And he uses a kind of a series of if statements when he does this. So if you turn over to Job chapter 31 and verses 3 to 8, just looking at a couple of them, he says, "Is not destruction to the wicked and a strange punishment to the workers of iniquity?" So he says punishment and wickedness are deserved because they are wicked. They deserve punishment. He says, "Doth not he see my ways and count all my steps?" So he's saying, but look at me, though, and what I've done. "If I have walked with vanity, or if my foot hath hasted to deceit, let me be weighed in an even balance that God may know my integrity." And so he's pretty confident in his integrity. And so there's this problem of, why have I been afflicted like this then? He goes on and he says this several times in verse 13. If I did despise the cause of my manservant or of any of my maidservants when they contended with me, what then shall I do when God riseth up and when he visiteth? What shall I answer him? And he continues to go on. I've kind of highlighted all the ifs because you can see them through in verse 20. If his loins have not blessed me, and if he were not warmed with the fleece of my sheep, if I have lifted up my hand against the fatherless. And so he makes a strong case for what he believes is his integrity and why he doesn't think he's deserved any of these things. And so there's this back and forth between Job and his three friends. He's trying to profess his integrity. Meanwhile, they're beating him down by saying, that can't be right. You can't be right because look at what's befallen you. You have to be a sinner. There's no other explanation for this. And so at the end of this speech, the sort of the grueling debate between Job and his three friends comes to an end at the towards the end of chapter 31. So if you look there, in verses 35 to the end, he says, oh, that one would hear me. Behold, my desire is that the Almighty would answer me and that mine adversary had written a book. Now, it's very interesting that he says that because he does get his answer in the end. It's not quite what he expected, but he definitely gets an answer from God. Surely I would take it upon my shoulder and bind it as a crown to me. I would declare unto him the number of my steps. As a prince would I go near unto him. If my land cry against me, or that the furrows likewise thereof complain, if I have eaten the fruits thereof without money, or have caused the owners thereof to lose their life, let thistles grow instead of wheaten, and cockle instead of barley, the words of Job are ended. And that's kind of how he ends up this long series of speeches. And when you look at everything that's happened to date, sort of all three friends have failed in making their respective cases and come to a mutual conclusion. And it appears that Job has failed to convince them of his righteousness and his lack of guilt. And so you get chapter 32 and verse 1. So these three men ceased to answer Job because he was righteous in his own eyes. And so we continue from there. Excuse me. Before God takes up the argument, or even begins to join into this conversation, there is another side of the case that needs to be presented yet. And that's presented by the voice, this really impassioned voice, excuse me, of the younger Elihu. Now, the name Elihu means, my God is he. And we're going to look at that in further detail because I think it's really important to the story. And he had preserved a really respectful silence, sitting, listening to the elders while they were speaking. But he was convinced that both sides were wrong and God needed to be vindicated. So if you look at chapter 32 and verses 2 to 4, it says, then was kindled the wrath of Elihu, the son of Barachel, the Buzite, of the kindred of Ram. Against Job was his wrath kindled because he justified himself rather than God. Also, against his three friends was his wrath kindled because they had found no answer and yet had condemned Job. Now, Elihu had waited till Job had spoken because they were elder than he. And again in verse 12, we're just taking snippets out of this, but he says, yea, I attended unto you, and behold, there was none of you that convinced Job or that answered his words. So he'd held his peace during their conversation to that point. And he could finally take it no more, he says. And so he speaks up because he's very angry with Job for justifying himself rather than God, and with Job's three friends because they'd found no way to refute Job and had condemned him. Now, we're not going to get into this in depth. It's too bad because it's really interesting. But if you start with a very brief overview of Elihu's speech, we're going to start there and we're going to come back to it again just briefly before we look at God's speech. But in chapter 33, if you kind of go through it very rapidly, Elihu turns his attention to Job, squarely his attention to Job. And he declares Job wrong in saying that he was without sin and that God would not answer or respond. And so in Job chapter 33, in verses 12 and 13, he says, "Behold in this, thou art not just. I will answer thee that God is greater than man. Why dost thou strive against him? Or he giveth not account of any of his matters." And so then he shifts focus a little bit and turns to God's justice, the justice that God metes out. In chapter 34, if you turn over the page, in verse, we're going to look at just a couple of verses, 12 to 14. He says, "Yea, surely God will not do wickedly, neither with the Almighty pervert judgment. Who hath given him a charge over the earth, or who hath disposed the whole world? If he set his heart upon man, if he gather unto him his spirit and his breath," and so forth. And he says, basically, if he withdrew himself, everything would perish, certainly on the earth and outside of the earth. Because he's basically making the case he's constantly maintaining creation. And so in chapter 35, Elihu again turns to Job in condemnation. If you turn over a page, chapter 35, verses 13 to 16, he says, "Surely God will not hear vanity, neither with the Almighty regard it. Although thou sayest thou shalt not see him, yet judgment is before him. Therefore trust thou in him." He's appealing to him. "But now, because it is not so, he hath visited his anger, yet he knoweth it not in great extremity. Therefore doth Job open his mouth in vain. He multiplieth words without knowledge." And so he multiplieth words without knowledge seems like an overly harsh kind of condemnation about Job. But we're looking at it from our point of view. Elihu's trying to get Job to look at it from God's point of view, which is what's quite important with this. In Job chapter 36 and verse 26, he's sort of coming to the end of his monologue that he gives. And he says, "Behold, God is great, and we know him not, neither can the number of his years be searched out." So God is great, and what the word "know" there really means to perceive, to understand. I mean, they obviously all knew God, knew of God. I mean, Job was an upright man. He was a good man, in quotes. And I'll use that in quotes because I think we learn more about Job as we go on. But he was a good man. Certainly from our perspective, he seems to be an exemplary man. And Elihu points out, though, that we don't really know him, or they hadn't really considered God and knowing him to a great spiritual depth. And he says that's important in understanding what God is probably going to say and respond to this. So Elihu rightly points to God's might, as he's done for the entire speech, and he finishes with this little bit at the end of chapter 37, verses 14 to 20, where he says, "Okay, hearken unto this, O Job. Stand still and consider the wondrous works of God. Dost thou know when God disposed them and caused the light of his cloud to shine? Do you know the balances of the clouds, the wondrous works of him which is perfect in knowledge? How thy garments are warm when he quieteth the earth by the south wind? Hast thou with him spread out the sky, which is strong and as a molten looking glass? Teach us what we shall say unto him, for we cannot order our speech by reason of darkness. Shall it be told him that I speak? If a man speak, surely he'll be swallowed up." And so Elihu makes a strong case, trying to impress upon Job that there's nothing in what man has done that can compare to God and his creation. And he emphasizes this in his final statements to Job and to the three friends, because they're all sitting around discussing this. It's all interesting, and it's worthy of studies in themselves. But there's something else that's happening here, and you may have noticed this before. It didn't really become apparent to me until I really started to look into this. But there's something else that's happening at the same time, which I think is really, really important. Because if God wanted to impress upon Job in particular, because he wants to save him and help him, obviously, he's going to have to do something pretty dramatic, really dramatic, because obviously the argument between the three friends and Job hasn't achieved anything. In fact, they're completely polarized. And Elihu, as making a strong case as he is more or less falling on deaf ears because, again, it hasn't achieved what they're hoping for yet. And you might sort of think, as you're reading through Job, maybe mistakenly, that all through the debates back and forth between Job and his three friends, God is patiently waiting his turn, as if there is a turn for God. And it almost seems like that because you get this back and forth, back and forth. Finally, a summary by Job and then Elihu comes in. And then we get God coming forth. And I use the word patiently really respectfully when I think of God and what he's doing here. But you have to really attempt to visualize what's happening. Not just read the words, but I think it's really important to actually get a picture in your mind as to what is really happening here. So if you imagine the situation, just similar to this, Job and his three friends and Elihu have been sitting somewhere, probably outside somewhere, debating the righteousness or lack of righteousness of Job. Job is now completely demoralized. He's deathly sick. He's attempting to vindicate himself and getting nowhere with it. Under the constant, perhaps well-meaning onslaught of his three friends, Job is defending himself over and over again. And then in the final speech by Elihu, he steps in and upbraids all of them, but specifically targets Job with that Job's argument and his vindication. During the debate of the three friends and Job, Elihu has been listening attentively, but he's been listening not just to Job and his three friends. He's been listening to a growing storm that's happening. And I don't know if you've seen this yourself, but there's a storm approaching, and it's a literal storm. It's not just a figurative storm, but there is a significant storm. If you turn to Job chapter 36, verses 26 to 33. "Behold, God is great," Elihu says, "and we know him not, neither can the number of his years be searched out. For he maketh small the drops of water. They pour down rain according to the vapor thereof, which the clouds do drop and distill upon man abundantly. Also can any understand the spreading of the clouds or the noise of his tabernacle? Behold, he spreadeth his light upon it and covereth the bottom of the sea. For by them judgeth he the people. He giveth meat in abundance. With clouds he covereth the light and commandeth it not to shine by the cloud that cometh betwixt. The noise thereof showeth concerning it, the cattle also concerning the vapor." When you look at the words that Elihu is using, those weren't the words he started with, but now he's bringing into it the noise of his tabernacle. That's thunder. The clouds in verse 32. The noise again, the thunder coming through in verse 33. In continuing on into chapter 37, in verses 1 to 5, it starts to build now, and you can really start to see the building of this storm. "At this also my heart trembleth and is moved out of his place. Hear attentively the noise of his voice and the sound that goeth out of his mouth. He directeth it unto the whole heaven and his lightning unto the ends of the earth. After it a voice roareth, he thundereth with the voice of his excellency, and he will not stay them when his voice is heard. God thundereth marvelously with his voice. Great things doeth he which we cannot comprehend." And so as Elihu's starting to round up his speech to Job, this storm, this incredible storm, is building and building. The noise of his voice, the sound of his mouth, the lightning, the thunder. And I think what's happening, it certainly could be proved wrong, but there's a literal and a significant storm moving in. And while he continues to talk, his speech is kind of interweaving what's actually going on around him. The rain begins to fall, and he begins to draw and weave into his speech the weather as it moves in. And amidst that backdrop, after Elihu is finished, God is going to speak out of that storm, out of the whirlwind. Now, it's not just an interesting fact, I think, but it adds to the overall impact of exactly why God wants to make a tremendous impact on Job. He's pulling out all the stops, essentially. It's kind of like a symphony where it sort of slowly builds into a great crescendo, and, you know, like the 1812 Overture or something like that. That's almost what this is like. It's not just the building of the argument of Elihu to a point where God then steps in and starts to speak, and Job is suddenly convinced of that. There is a lot going on. And so if you keep all of that in your mind, this tremendous building storm, you can sort of consider what Elihu is happening. He's looking around and seeing all this happening because it's more important than I think we give it credit. Now, Elihu was one of Job's friends, I think. Not one of the three who were there at the beginning to comfort Job, but one who was introduced last and has the single longest speech to Job. He's identified as the son of Barachel the Buzite of the family of Ram. And just breaking that information down a bit, I thought that was interesting when I looked at that. It's obviously important because God has placed it there. And so it seems that Elihu had a lineage and an important lineage. Now, again, some of this might be a bit subjective, but if you were to look at a breakdown of what Elihu, his name means and his lineage means, it becomes quite important, I think. Elihu means God of him, he is my God, or my God is he. Son of Barachel, God blesses. The Buzite of the kindred of, and many people believe this is the second son of Nahor, the brother of Abraham. So if you've ever sort of wondered what the time frame is of Job, this might give a bit of a hint. It's obviously after the time of Nahor and Abraham at some point. So it helps to build context, and probably before Moses, obviously. So, but Ram, high or exalted. So if you kind of string that together in a sentence, this is what I came up with. My God is he who God blesses and exalts. Now, my God is he who God blesses and exalts. So many people believe that the Buzites and Ram refer to Buz, the son of Nahor, the brother of Abraham. The mention of the genealogy, I think, is important because it gives us a clue to the time frame and his lineage. And it also gives Elihu some added credibility, too, because he's a young guy talking this way to a group of the elders of the city. Really important, actually. You could see how Job sees himself in situation in the place where they lived as being the most important elder there. And his three friends were obviously as important as he was. So Elihu coming along and telling them that they were wrong could have been easily challenged. And yet Elihu seems to have some credibility. His name means, my God is he. He appears suddenly in the record and disappears just as suddenly. But when you break down his speech and read it right the way through in the context of the rest of Job, it suddenly makes a lot of sense. And when you further analyze that he's the only person in the story who has a really defined lineage, you can see that it maybe has even greater significance. So I state that because I actually think Elihu is the, if you want to pick who is the correct one in all of this, Job, his three friends, it's Elihu. If you want to know who to believe and count on what they're saying, I would say that you can count on what Elihu is saying. You can read Elihu's speech because it's followed closely on by what God says. He offers a response to Job that lifts up God, and it sharply rebukes the three friends and rightly confronts Job's, and you might as well say it the way it is, gross misunderstanding of God. And that doesn't mean Job wasn't an upright man and he wasn't a good man. Certainly from our perspective, he was a great man, really. But he grossly misunderstood God and what God was trying to do. If you go back to Job chapter 32 and look at verses 2 to 3, he says, there was kindled the wrath of Elihu, the son of Barachel, the Buzite, of the kindred of Ram. Against Job was his wrath kindled because he justified himself rather than God. That's what his argument was all about, justifying himself. Also against his three friends was his wrath kindled because they found no way to refute Job and yet had condemned him. So they didn't understand either, obviously. So in short, Elihu condemns Job's friends and Job's claim of being without sin. And he declares God's justice. He condemns Job's attitude toward God. And in the end, exalts Job's greatness, or God's greatness. So Elihu's four-part speech is followed by God finally breaking his silence to directly answer Job. And so in Job chapter 42, which Brother Mike read for us tonight, it says in verse 7, "It was so that after the Lord had spoken these words unto Job, the Lord said to Eliphaz the Temanite, 'My wrath is kindled against thee and against thy two friends, for ye have not spoken of me the thing that is right as my servant Job hath.'" When Job finally spoke, that is, not in the speeches. So that's important. Most importantly, Elihu is not mentioned again after he finishes this speech, and he's not rebuked by God, interestingly enough. It appears, at least to me anyways, that Elihu accurately focused on the important aspects of what was really going on with Job. So when God begins laying out for Job this grand speech, which he does, the intricacies and majesty of his creation, I think it helps to understand then exactly what's going on. Why does he not focus? I guess the question I ask myself when I'm going into after Elihu's speech is, I would have expected, if you sort of followed it through logically, that what God would do when he finally did speak was look at the arguments of the three friends and of Job and pick them apart and show them why they were wrong. You would assume, at least I assumed, that that's what you'd be looking for, is God addressing all the points that they had made and showing them where they had either erred or they were right or whatever he does. But he actually doesn't do any of that. He doesn't do any of that. He doesn't focus on the discussions of the friends. He doesn't even mention it, actually, in any of these things. Actually, it seems to be a continuation of what Elihu is saying. There's a great deal of irony here, I think, because the wisdom involved in the creation of the world is wisdom which man simply does not possess and struggles to understand, even in our day and age. But God asked Job, "Do you understand it all? Were you there? You seem to think and speak like you do." And ultimately, from God's perspective, and this seems rather harsh, I think, when you look at it from God's perspective and not from our perspective, Job's problems are minute in the overall scheme of things. They really are. God's response is there to educate Job. It's there to liberate him from an unhealthy and inward self-focus, and it asks him to look outwards, which in itself is one of the great lessons of Job. Perhaps that's the hardest lesson that we struggle to appreciate. I certainly can speak from experience. Regardless of what we know what God says, and I think Job had a pretty good understanding of the Word of God, our human nature pressures us to self-vindication, always. That's what it does. Self-vindication, self-preservation, and all these other things. Each of us know that Job really had a struggle with this. He really struggled with it because he honestly felt vindicated, and he did not deserve the difficulties that he was having, all the trials that he encountered. In truth, when you think about it, which one of us wouldn't feel the way Job felt? And he was a good man under the serious trials that he had faced. When we look at it from our lens, our perspective, it's easy to feel sympathy for Job. What Elihu does is he goes back to a really profound and simple understanding of our own human nature and God, and it's all back to the type of things that Jesus expressed. If you just turn to Mark chapter 7 briefly. This is the only time we'll leave Job, I think. Mark chapter 7 and verses 20 to 23, where Jesus said, "For from within, out of the heart of man, proceed evil thoughts, adulteries, fornications, murders, thefts, covetousness, wickedness, deceit, lasciviousness, an evil eye, blasphemy, pride, foolishness. All these evil things come from within and defile the man. Now, that's not easy to hear. That isn't easy to hear. Nobody likes to hear that those things said because they apply to all of us, unfortunately. It's really easy, too, like Job's three friends, to point out the fault of other people. I don't recall reading in any of the arguments of the three friends where they said, well, look, Job, you know, I really struggle with this particular problem as well. And, you know, I've sinned a few times myself, and as a result, you know, things have happened to me. You don't hear them focusing on themselves at all. You hear them hammering to Job because it's really easy to see the faults of others. It's not hard at all. We quickly find ways to vindicate ourselves, and then when something does happen to us, we bemoan our own situation and the challenges we're facing, and then look at somebody else and say, why don't they get it? Like, what's their problem? Like, it seems so easy from my perspective. My trials, and then when you look at your own trials, you think, well, my trials are so much greater than theirs. My situation just can't compare to the kind of insignificant things that they're dealing with. What is their problem? That's kind of what the three friends were doing with Job. All the while, we forget or misplace the fact that none of us are even remotely worthy of any of God's mercies and graces. Not worthy of them. That doesn't mean he doesn't give them to us, because he does. But it means that we're not worthy of any of them. That, in fact, we have no right, as they seem to think, I think, as Job seemed to think, that he had a right to wealth and happiness and prosperity and health. He had that right because he hadn't sinned, or at least he didn't sin in his own mind. And so that was his mindset, or any of the things he felt he was owed or deserved because he was a good man. The fact is that sin, or any sin, even the tiniest sin, has alienated us from God. And the only thing that ever reconciles us back to God is his mercy. You can see it happening in your own life. I mean, if you stop and analyze yourself, you can see how we tend to rationalize these things. It's really easy, I think, for us to understand Job, because that's the way we feel about ourselves oftentimes. Poor Job. He had lost so much of the material things that we place value on. When you look at all the things that Job had, we place a lot of value on them, intrinsic value on them. And I don't mean that in a facetious way, because we can really empathize with Job. It's easy for us to grieve with him. He had lost everything that the world considers important: his crops, his herds, his wealth, his family, and finally in his health. And in his wife's mind, understandably, from our point of view, there was nothing else to do but curse God and die. And in his friend's mind, he had obviously been a great sinner and deserved everything that was happening to him. They could find fault with him pretty easily because they're looking at it from a different lens. In his own mind, he couldn't think of anything that would cause God to punish him like that. At least that's the way he thought, what he thought was happening. And that's the real lesson of Job, in my humble opinion. That's what it all boils down to. All 42 chapters of Job are designed to focus our attention on looking at things from God's view and not our own view. It is a different perspective altogether. So he challenged Job. When he finally spoke, he challenged him. What did he really deserve? And that's almost what he says. Was he God? Was he righteous? Was Job perfect? Was he sinless? And of course, the more God said, the harder it was to not deny it anymore. Of course not. As good as Job was, he wasn't any of those things, really. Perhaps God does not lose patience in the same way we might be, but there are limits to what God can take as well, and he sets limits on what he's willing to do. And so you get all these this discussion back and forth, and at the same time, this massive storm is building up. This incredible storm is building up, a literal storm. And as the storm continues to build, going back to Elihu again, he obviously sensed the need to conclude his speech because things were getting a bit dicey, for sure. The rain was coming, pouring down. It was lightning and thunder. The wind was blowing, howling, like a hurricane almost. And he had to conclude, because soon it would be impossible to talk. There's definitely a sense of urgency. If you look at chapter 37 and verses 20 on, he says, "Shall it be told him that I speak?" In regards to God, "If a man speak, surely he shall be swallowed up. And now men see not the bright light which is in the clouds, but the wind passeth and cleanseth them. Fair weather cometh out of the north, with God is terrible majesty. Touching the Almighty, we cannot find him out. He is excellent in power and in judgment and in plenty of justice. He will not afflict. Men do therefore fear him. He respecteth not any that are wise of heart." And of course, wise of heart in this context is wisdom in the sense of the world. And so then God speaks, and he speaks out of the whirlwind, which I find fascinating. Job 38, verse 1. "Then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind and said..." Now that's not the same word for whirlwind that Elihu used earlier. There's two words for whirlwind. The first word in chapter 37 and verse 9 is sufa, which means a storm, like a kind of a thunderstorm sort of a thing. The second word, sira, signifies something turbulent, tumultuous, violently agitated, I think as Strong says. And here may signify what we call a tempest. It's even called a hurricane in some places. This is a really violent storm, not, you know, going for a walk in a bit of a thunderstorm by any means. This is much greater than that. And it was intended to fill this little group with awe, with solemnity, but particularly Job, an awful sense of the majesty of God and his power, a real, literal, maybe hurricane blowing as God is thundering this message to Job. And so he speaks, and he speaks out of it. Now, when God speaks, so we've mentioned this before, we won't look at it because we don't have a lot of time, but he asked Job 77 questions in total. Find that interesting in itself, but we won't get to that. That Job simply can't find an answer for any of them. He has no response to any of the 77 questions God asks him. So from chapters 38 to 41, in four chapters, God speaks. And the whole purpose of God speaking out of this tempest is to show Job and his friends that God is far beyond any of them. Can you imagine what that must have been like? Hearing this massive storm, while God is thundering this message out of the storm. And it would have been impressive is an understatement, I think. And so we have the section where God asks the most concentrated set of questions in the entire Bible. There's no place in the Bible where you will find kind of a concentration of God asking question after question after question. 77 questions in four chapters. I think it might be confusing to look at the rapid-fire series of questions that reduce all their arguments to insignificance. Saying that, I think if you go through it, and if you really start to analyze it, which we won't do tonight because there's not enough time, but you can distill it down, I think, into three basic questions. That's what this is all about, I think. Where God is basically saying, do you comprehend my creation? Do you understand it? Of course, the answer to all of those questions is no. Do you care for my creation? Are you the one who's responsible for it? Of course, the answer is no. Do you control my creation? And of course, the obvious answer again is no. How could Job respond to any of that? And there's a really interesting aspect to this. God's first speech doesn't really explain the cause of Job's suffering, which you'd think God might do, or reveal a list of God's sins, which we talked about before. It doesn't address God's argument, or Job's argument, that he didn't deserve what had happened to him. It doesn't address the three friends' arguments that he must be a great sinner to deserve such punishment. So for all the arguments back and forth, it can all be condensed into what God says to them here in these four chapters. And that deserves repeating, I think, because that's Job in a nutshell. That's what Job is all about. Central to the argument of everything Job and his three friends do have to do with the understanding, their understanding of righteousness and suffering and punishment and justice. We would expect, after listening to all of these speeches, that God would go through them and analyze them and tell them where they'd got it wrong. But that's exactly the opposite of what God does. He does something completely different. And so you ask the question, well, why is that then? Why doesn't God do that? I think if it were possible to divest ourselves of every bit of self-interest, every bit of selfishness and ego, we would probably see everyone else through the eyes of Jesus Christ. That's what we would end up being. That's not the way we see things, unfortunately. All of us, except for Christ, see things through the lens of our own self-interest, I think. Our focus and that's the way we're built, unfortunately. And we struggle against it day after day after day. It's a constant struggle. I seem to be getting a little bit older, and it doesn't seem to be getting any easier. It's a constant struggle your entire life because you need to be reminded daily about the majesty of God. I think that's what needs to happen. And God is using the most impressive way possible of teaching that lesson to Job. I mean, there's times, I'm sure, albeit rare, when we might do a pretty good job of divesting ourselves of that view, that selfish view, but mostly we see the world as if we are in control of everything, or we are central to everything. My thinking is those times are rare. How else can you explain the book of Job? I don't know of any other explanation for it. How else can we explain why Elihu and God go to such lengths to focus on God's majesty, God's mighty power, God's wisdom, and most importantly, God's righteousness? So what they're saying is God's given us life. He's offered us an opportunity at eternal salvation. He offers us forgiveness when we fail him. He does all of those things. Beyond that, there's nothing in here that says we have any right or privilege to expect anything beyond what God is gracious in giving to us. In all those 77 questions, he addresses this aspect of our natures. Not the questions that have been raised by Job and his friends, but whether Job's righteousness, or whether he deserved punishment or trial, or even questioning his sinlessness. It always goes back fundamentally to God and God's judgment. In fact, after chapters 38 and 39, there's a brief pause in Job's speech. If you just go to Job chapter 40, there's kind of this pause right in the middle where he says, where the record says, "Moreover, the Lord answered Job and said, Shall he that contendeth with the Almighty instruct him, he that reproveth God? Let him answer it. Let him answer it, yes. And so if you look at another version, it says, "Moreover, God answered Job, Shall he who argues contend with the Almighty? He who argues with God, let him answer it. So if you think you know better, tell me about it then." You know, how could Job possibly respond to that statement? What could Job possibly say? Is there anything he can say to help God understand his situation or try and explain away what's happening? Is he going to try and vindicate himself to God now, is the question? So who is Job to contend or argue with God? Who is Job to contend with or to question God's motives or God's right to give and to take away? That's something he knew already. When you think of it, Job already knew a lot of this stuff. He knew a lot of it. It just hadn't sunk into him, I think, and he hadn't fully appreciated what exactly was the point of God's righteousness and blessings? In chapter 1 and 21, he says, naked came I out of my mother's womb, and naked shall I return thither. The Lord gave, and the Lord hath taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. That's a very righteous attitude and way of looking at things. So he had an idea about what God was trying to sort of drill into him. He just needed to see it not as a fact, like, yes, we will be raised from the dead, but he needed to really believe it from the perspective of God, which is most important. That important fact that he said in Job 1 and 21 had been lost in the ensuing arguments between Job and the three friends. I think Elihu had not lost sight of it. And now God reminds Job of this. And when Job responds in chapter 40 and verse 3, he says, he answered the Lord and said, behold, I am vile. What shall I answer you? I will lay my hand upon my mouth. Once have I spoken, but I will not answer. Yea, twice, but I will proceed no further. And so in another version it says, I must look insignificant to you. How can I answer you? I'm speechless. I spoke once, but I can't answer. I tried a second time, but I won't do so anymore. This is a seriously humbled Job now, and a contrite Job. Now he is the depth of what God is trying to say. He's understanding. But God continues to make his point in the next chapter here, next two chapters actually, because to make sure there's no ambiguity at all about how great he is. And so again, you get this out of the world wind again. So the storm is still raging. Same word for hurricane, essentially. Then answered the Lord in verse 6 unto Job, out of the world wind, and said, gird up thy loins now like a man. I will demand of thee and declare thou unto me, wilt thou also disannul my judgment? Wilt thou condemn me that thou mayest be righteous? Hast thou an arm like God, or canst thou thunder with a voice like him? You can see what he's saying to Job. You know, it seems a little harsh that he's going at him so strongly, but he wants it to be absolutely clear, not only to Job and his three friends, but to everybody from that time forward. So everybody who has read Job from that time forward now has a better understanding, I think, of what God is trying to say to all of us. And so the storm continues to rage around Job. Elihu and the three friends, all this is going on. God uses the examples of the behemoth and the Leviathan, which we won't even get into tonight because there's not time. And he concludes at the end of chapter 1, in chapter 41 rather, and begins sort of this consideration of putting the final, closing the argument, so to speak, where he says, canst thou draw out Leviathan, etc. And then he concludes that after talking about Leviathan, and in chapter 42, which Mike read for us tonight, we have the first six verses, where Job finally responds then, after all of this, and he says, I know that thou canst do everything, and that no thought can be withholden from thee. Who is he? Who is he? He's answering God's question. He's saying God's question. Who is he that hideth counsel without knowledge? Therefore have I uttered that I understood not. I really didn't understand at all. Things too wonderful for me, which I knew not. Hear, I beseech thee, and I will speak. I will demand of thee and declare thereunto unto me. He's not saying that to God. He's saying what God said to him. I have heard of thee by the hearing of the ear, but now mine eye seeth thee. Wherefore I abhor myself and repent in dust and ashes. So there's simply nothing more that Job can say. He has heard of God, he said, and I think he did. He was a godly man. He was a righteous man to a degree. And in this one area, he needed to learn an important lesson. All of us need to learn that important lesson. He had listened, and most importantly, had taken it to heart. He really believed it now. He thought he understood God, but he says now he seeth him. And the word see there doesn't just mean see, it means perceive it. It means understand. Much more than visual sight, but perception. Although he had perhaps seen maybe angels come when that may have been, they had come when there were sacrifices to be made, or that sort of thing. He had certainly seen the great storm which manifested itself. But now he really spiritually understood who God was. And he was actually starting to look at it now, instead of from his own perspective, he was seeing himself through God's eyes now. Quite a different way of looking at things. As a result, he understood that whatever trials life might bring, and he'd had a few of them, however difficult, ultimately God is in control of things. And if we put our trust and confidence in him, he will bring us to the kingdom. That is a promise he's given us. Job already knew that. But it's always more challenging, I think, when we're in the midst of trials. It's really challenging to see that in the midst of trials. Finally, we know that ultimately God blessed Job with much more than he had before. God didn't have to do that. There was no requirement that God would do anything else for Job. But he did it for Job. Job would have accepted that fact, and he would have glorified God regardless if he had gotten nothing after that, because he was now seeing himself through God's eyes. And he understood a lot of lessons that God was trying to teach him. God's gift of bringing back his children, of doubling his wealth, is evidence, really, of God's great mercy and his grace. Look at what he's done for Job. If we would just acknowledge him and appreciate the fact that, really, we don't deserve much of anything, actually. There's no promise that we'll be wealthy or rich or powerful or have big houses or fancy cars, or even health. God hasn't promised any of those things. But we do know what he has promised for us, us. So just kind of concluding with this particular passage, I think, is appropriate. We say this quite often. If somebody's leaving or we're thinking of somebody who we really love and care for, just like the Jews do occasionally. The Lord bless thee and keep thee. The Lord make his face shine upon thee and be gracious unto thee. The Lord lift up his countenance upon thee and give thee peace. Now, just one final thought. I think that last phrase is the most important piece of this whole puzzle. Not give us prosperity or health or things in any way, shape, or form. God has promised to give us peace. Now, it seems a bit arbitrary, but what could possibly be better? What could we wish for more for each other than peace? We wouldn't say, you know, I hope that you get that big house you were looking for when you move or something. We would say this because we really want the best for people. And the best for people is that God would bless them and give them peace. What, of course, God is offering to us, as everybody in this little group, I think, came to understand, is it's not wealth or good fortune or power or even health, any of the things that we put intrinsic value on. God promises us peace, shalom. And it can only come when we give up our own worldly ambitions and desires and sort of accept the liberating gift that God is trying to show us to see the world through his eyes instead of our own, and the hope of life eternal in the kingdom. And as Paul says, may the peace of God, which passeth all understanding, and keep your hearts through Jesus Christ. Keep your hearts and minds through Christ Jesus. Thanks.